This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all Have Another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, HRRN Nation, and welcome to the show trainers listen to. It is Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you once again and extending a special welcome to everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220 XM Channel 206, and to everyone tuning in on our website, on your smartphone, or on your tablet with our live streaming at horseracingradio.net. Welcome to Trainer Talk in a very special edition. Looking forward to our guest here this evening. It is 58-year-old Larry Jones, the native of Hopkinsville, Kentucky. He has trained 952 winners to date, so closing in on that 1,000 win milestone. More than $41 million in purses to his credit, at least to his runner's credit. And he is with me now on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Larry, welcome to the show.
Well, glad to be with you, Mike.
Happy to have you on board. And, you know, it's interesting when I look at Larry Jones. I look at somebody who has always been more than accommodating with the media, who many people would describe as one of the nicest guys you're going to meet in the sport. And I also look at somebody who maybe epitomizes that saying that we hear in the sport, highest highs, lowest lows. You've been on both ends of that spectrum, my friend.
Well, we really have, yeah. And there's nothing like the highest highs, and the lowest are as low as you can get.
Yeah, they certainly are. Let's go back to the beginning. That's what this show is all about. Growing up in Western Kentucky, and you just told me a short time ago before we came on the air that you were right by Fort Campbell,
right?
And used to watch the paratroopers jump into the out of the planes.
Right.
That's amazing.
It was the home of the 101st Airborne Division. So yeah, we got to sit right there in our front yard and watch it all happen, all the practicing.
Do you remember getting a chance to meet any of the members of the 101st Airborne?
Well, the one I met the most was my uncle. He was part of it. So yes, it was very good, and he would kind of let us know when the days would be that they were going to be jumping, so we knew when to watch.
He must have had some amazing stories.
Oh, absolutely. And what a great guy he was. It was just an honor now, and especially now to get to be around him and know what all he did do. What an honor.
Yeah. Did you come from a horse racing background at all?
Well, no, not really, unless you plowed real fast with horses. My grandfather on my mother's side, he was one of those that really believed those tractors will never replace these horses. They can never be done. And so he farmed with horses, and so that was part of it, and the mules. Then my dad wound up, we farmed, but we wound up having a lot of cattle. So needless to say, I got to ride horses a lot, you know, working with the cattle. And so and young kids like speed. So every time they wasn't watching, I was trying to see how fast each and every horse could run. So, yeah, it just kind of evolved.
Did you ever think that maybe you wanted to be a jockey instead of a trainer?
Well, at that time, I was debating whether I wanted to be a jockey or a basketball player. And so those really don't they don't mingle. But my dad was one of the he was like 6'4" and a half, and you know, and he could play guard in the days when tall guys like that wasn't playing guard. So you know, I had the basketball influence on that side, and then the horses off the other side. So I just got right dead in the middle. I got in the middle. I couldn't do either one.
Was your dad a horse racing fan?
Oh, I think a lot of people are fans. Now, he didn't. He grew up. He was a city kid. And did not grow up, you know, with horses, but he loved them. And then, of course, when we got the cattle operation going, he rode all the time. And it was a very good horseman himself, yeah.
That's an amazing story. You would think somebody like Larry Jones, somebody in your position with all the success you've had in the sport, that you were born into it, that this was your life from the very beginning, but that's not the case.
No, absolutely not. And but it just evolved. And of course, you grew up in all the sporting events around the little horse shows and all. So it just kept going.
So what's your earliest memory of going to the racetrack?
To be honest with you, it was probably 1979 was my first visit to the thoroughbred track.
Yeah.
And I'd already got a thoroughbred, so I thought, well, I better go figure this out. Now, I was I was a quarter horse guy. We did the quarter horse running and stuff like that. So that started back in the mid-70s. But whenever it evolved over to thoroughbreds, it was like 1979.
Who took you to the track for the first time?
The people that I wound up training for there in Hopkinsville, Frank and Shirley Pitzer, they were the reason that I went. And, of course, I went on my own, but they had horse racing. And I thought, well, let me go up and see what this is all about, because I had gone to school with their daughter.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and there was thoroughbreds in my county. So I did not know that for a long time. So, yeah,
wow.
So it was good.
Were you hooked on it from the very beginning?
Well, like I said, all young kids are hooked on speed, and my dad had always figured that I was a lot better racing horses than I was racing cars or motorcycles, because at least the horse would think a little bit, and if you tried to tell him to do something really stupid, maybe the horse would say no, and he knew that motorcycle or car was going to do what you told it to do, so as long as I kept it at that, he was good.
Did your dad encourage you to get involved in the sport when you finally decided that, hey, this is kind of neat and I'd like to be around it?
Well, absolutely. And like I said, he always loved horses, and we always had the arena horses growing up, you know, when I was in school. And that's how I got my first broken leg. I qualified for the National Flag Racing Championship when I was like 17. And needless to say, I wound up going through a fence and over, and the horse landing on you. So there's first broken bone.
Wow.
And so then I decided, well, I need something bigger than an arena. Let me try a racetrack. And so it just kept going from there.
Yeah. How do you qualify for the Flag Racing Championships?
Well, you just do a whole lot of horse shows and do a lot of winning, yeah.
Talking with trainer Larry Jones on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. First broken leg. How many have there been?
Well, as far as that's the only time the leg got. Now, how many broken bones has been numerous? And a lot of times we get, you know, four or five at a time whenever you go down. But I haven't kept count, but I do know when I go in for x-rays, and the last time I did my foot and thought it was probably broke, the x-ray said, well, yeah, it is broke, but you broke it before because we're seeing all the other breaks.
Wow.
And so I remember I was in Iowa, and I told him, the doctor, what all I thought was broke. And it was a collarbone, three ribs, it had punctured my lung, broke that foot. And he told me, he said, well, every place you said was broke. He said, this isn't your first injury, is it? I said, well, no. He said, well, everywhere you think you're broke, you are broke. And he said, you think you're broke anywhere else? I said, no, I think everything else is just bruised. But that's part of it.
We have another show on the network called Jock Talk, which airs on Tuesday nights. And jockeys will come on and talk about their life. And so often they talk about the injuries they sustained. And it just goes on and on and on. And I always ask them, what makes you want to get back on that horse again after a serious injury? And they said it's the thrill of winning a race and that adrenaline rush that you get. Okay, for a trainer, you're not riding in the afternoons. You're not winning those races. What is it with Larry Jones that makes you want to get back on a horse?
Well, you know, a lot of people realize I was injured just last year, and what everybody knew was rather severe. I was probably the only one that didn't know it was severe because I was in a coma.
Yeah.
And so they didn't inform me until I come back, too. And I really felt like then, okay, probably my riding career is over and we'll go. But it was after about 5 weeks I was able to get back to driving and get back to the track, and I looked at my pony, and I thought, well, I was going to ride him. Didn't want my wife to know I'm going to ride the pony. I'm going to ride the pony. But I chickened out. I'll be honest with you. First time in my life I was ever scared to get on a horse. And I looked at him, and so I went home. And I tell him, God will, he deals with me in strange manners sometimes. So he just revealed to me and told me to get ride the pony that fear not. Because 10,000 arrows at your right side, 5,000 on the left, I'll protect you.
Yeah.
And that's why he told me. He said, you don't remember the fall. And I didn't. And he said that was his plan. Now, fear not, get back on the horse. This is what you do. And, boy, I had to think about it. But I thought, well, do you live and live the walk or just talk it? And so the next day I went out and attacked the pony. But I didn't want to ride because I was so dizzy, just that constant dizziness from that brain injury. And it was real funny. After about the first 100 yards, the dizziness quit. And it's like, oh, my gosh. You know?
Really?
So it was good. So and it lasted for about an hour after I got off the pony. But it was one of those rewards, I guess. You know, you follow God's plans and you get a reward. And so then I started riding every time. And so, yeah, it was, yeah, that's what we've done.
And that accident occurred just over a year ago.
April 19th.
And you don't remember anything about it?
I don't remember. I remember getting on the horses all, but they said I'd galloped him and was riding him back. And the horse is here at Keeneland right now. That is one horse I haven't been back on, and I keep telling him, and we're friends. I told him, I'm going to get you someday. One day I'm going to ride you, but it's not yet. And But no, it's it was just one of those mishaps. He got spooked or going back to the barn, and then got to bucking along the way, and some kind of way we came apart.
That's interesting that you're now back on horses. Again, I can never get my arms around that, and to what makes somebody want to get back on there. But as you said, you felt protected. You felt, and I would assume, Larry, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you probably feel most comfortable when you're on the back of a horse.
Well, it's true. And like I said, when the dizziness quit, I dealt with it for 5 weeks very severely. I mean, having even trouble walking, and tried to mow, and I didn't mow my yard. But I mean, it's like, wow, it was really different. My life had changed. But once I got back on that horse, my life was back. And I rode the ponies for about 3 weeks. As a matter of fact, I went ahead and broke another pony in that time. It's like, well, this guy here, I need to teach him to ride. I got time to ride him now. And then I'd even picked out my first thoroughbred that I knew I was going to ride. It took me a while to get around to doing it, but I knew who the first one would be that I was going to ride. And I did. She was a grass mare that we had, and knew she would be nice. But galloped her, and from then on, like I said, everything, my life was getting back to the way I knew my life. And right now, I feel normal.
Has that incident changed you as a person?
Well, I would say yes and no. I need to say I know I'm vulnerable, and you don't know if you got another fall left in you or not, that part. So it does make me cautious, and it makes me try to be a little bit more appreciative of every day that happens to go by. And, you know, it happened the day before Easter, so I celebrated this Easter, used that as my a deal instead of April 19th. And we may celebrate again on April 19th if I get through that day. So, but it's, you don't take every day just for granted. And you're very appreciative whenever everything goes. And to be here at Keeneland and looking out at all this, you just know you're happy to be here. Yeah.
How about your wife, Cindy? How trying was that on her?
To be honest with you, I feel like it was harder for her than me because she was having to deal with everything. Plus, that 5 weeks that I was making it from the bed to the recliner and learning how to work the remote for the TV, she was having to do all the work, plus play nursemaid to me. So, no, she made it so where I could get through it. But on her, it really wore and tore. And when I got back on the first horse, I'm sure she was more worried than I was. But it's all has been well.
She's had to do that a few times for you in your career, hasn't she?
She has, and it's not the only. I mean, it's not like I haven't got to do that for her too. Because needless to say, when you're in this game, everybody gets hurt. And she's had her share of injuries and the broken ribs and the broken feet and all. So yeah, I get pretty good at washing dishes and doing laundry and stuff like that when she's down. It was tough on her.
Where did you meet?
Actually, there at the farm that I was running, her mother worked for the doctor that I trained horses for at the hospital.
Okay.
And so he knew her, and she always loved horses, and she was just kind of had gotten between jobs, so she came out and was just going to help me for a couple of weeks, and that was in 1985, and those couple of weeks still haven't gotten over. She's still there, and she just loves the game and so good. I laugh, and we all laugh. She is the real life version of Ellie Mae Clampett. There's not an animal she can't come in. I mean, what? We had 31 wild turkey in our yard that she'd call up to feed.
Come on.
Oh, yeah. And the deer, and then the deer and the turkey would start fighting over the feed. And we've had every kind of wild animal for a pet, from raccoons. You know, we've had ferrets. It's just everything. She is a critter person. And, of course, right now she's spending most time with our parrot. We have an African gray parrot that is like our fifth child.
Really?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So it's she's very, very inclined and a great horsewoman. Bar none, all the animals are good, but she is so good with the horses. It's just, and she grew up riding, so now this is her game too.
Well, they say behind every great man is a great woman, and yeah. It sounds like you found your great woman.
She has done remarkable at this, and in order to tolerate me for 30 years now, like I said, I met her in 85. To tolerate me for 30 years, she's got to be kind of either strange or special or something.
Well, you talked about farming and growing up as a commercial farmer before going into training racehorses. Was it difficult to make that transition, or to at least make that decision to go into training horses?
Well, it really was, but if you look at the farming in the late 70s, and I put out my last crop of farming in 81, it was really tough, and we didn't have a lot of the government subsidy programs they have now and all. So it was really, really hard. And it was one of the deals. A lot of farmers were going bankrupt. They were being forced to sell out. And it was one of these deals, like, if I keep farming another 5 years, that may be me. Right now, I can sell out and pay out. So it was just, it was like, well, I'll try it. And if not, I'll come back. We didn't sell everything we had. We just enough that I could to try this horse stuff. And my first thoroughbred was an $800 horse. It doesn't take a lot to get me in the horse game.
Sure.
So it was hard to make that decision, but it's been good.
How did you come up with that first horse?
Well, it was still from the quarter horse days. I knew this guy that had the thoroughbred, and he had one he couldn't sell at the sale. So I thought, well, heck, that's me. And so I've made a good living on RNAs on the horses that couldn't meet the reserves. And that was the very first one, and she won. And that's what kind of was able to get me started and get me ahead in the game.
Yeah, tell me about the early days of Larry Jones. You ended up training for 20-some-odd years before your first graded stakes winner came along. So take me back to those early days. What was it like? Was it a struggle? How did you keep your head above water?
Well, without a doubt. And, I mean, when you look at the first 20 years, I don't know if we even grossed $100,000 in the first 20 years together. No, it was bad. I do know the first year I trained, I think the record show I made $3,300, and then the next time was $7,500 for the year. Not a race. It was the year. Then we went to like 11,000. I more than doubled in 1 year what I made the first 2 years previous. So we knew we were rolling. Actually, the doctors that I trained for there at the training center, I was just kind of a private trainer for them. And so at least I had a salary coming in. And that's what kept me being able to feed the kids, because I had two small children. But it worked out, and things finally started getting better. And the thing was, we were running good with what horses we had, although they weren't winning. If they got claimed off of us, they sure run a lot worse.
Sure.
If we ever claimed one, it ran better. So it didn't take them too long to start figuring, well, at least maybe I didn't have any stock, but at least I was doing my homework. And then I bought my first. I went to the yearling sales in 83, I guess it was, and bought my first stake winner. Give $800 for him. And I went to the Fasig Tipton sale and got him. And in 1986, he won the first stake that I was ever get to win. So it
wow.
just moved on.
They say pressure can be an amazing motivator. And with two small kids just starting out with a new career, that pressure had to be immense.
Well, it was. And, of course, the fact that you didn't want to prove to everybody you made a mistake by quitting farming. So, you know, and I've always been one of those, when the teachers tell you in school you can't do something, well, don't say that to Larry, because Larry's going to find a way to try to make it work. And perseverance pays off, but I was blessed with the ability to work a lot. You know, I could work 20-hour days and not faze me. I've never needed a lot of sleep. I'm catching up on that now. Now we're doing the sleep years. But it just was able to go. And like I said, we kind of did it in a strange way. I also ran the farm for these people, you know, or the broodmare operation as well. So we had it all in one place, as we called our little thoroughbred nursery. And I raised the hay, I raised the corn to feed them. So, you know, I kind of knew it all.
Were there times in those early years that you almost went back to farming and said, hey, the heck with this training stuff?
Well, once the doctor and Mrs. Pitzer passed away, that I trained for them for 14 years before they passed away. And then when I did go out on my own, and Cindy and I was on our own, I thought there was a couple times we was going to have to take bankruptcy and just quit. But the good Lord would bless us. We'd get a horse we could sell that we had owned, because I owned, you know, several of our horses. And he would shine on us enough that, okay, I could sell this horse and we could make the payroll and get the bills caught up and all. So he always found a way to make it work. We never prospered, but it was good, and we paid the bills. And it just, thank goodness she was dedicated as much as I was, Cindy was, and it some kind of how it made it work. I know when I went off to the track, I had four horses. My most expensive horse was an $800 horse. And this was the very first crop that I trained in 82. And I had $155 in my pocket, and a wife and two kids and a truck and a horse trailer. And that's it. And you can't do that. I mean, I can look at it now. I think you had to be crazy to even try it. No way I could do it again. And because we had no contacts, I never did know anybody in the thoroughbred business.
Yeah.
So, but as I said, the good Lord provides, and we're still here.
When you and Cindy get a little alone time and you're sitting out on the porch, looking out over the pasture, whatever it might be, the paddocks, and you have a chance to reflect upon everything that you've accomplished in your life together, does that segment of your life come rushing back and you say, geez, what, do you remember when we used to do this?
Well, every now and then we'll say when we used to do this, but usually now she's starting to say, you know, that board over there, you need to go nail that board up. And she's not worried about what we have done, what we've accomplished, what I need to do today. And, you know, these weeds are getting a little high around here. You got to clip under that fence. So no, we're still pushing forward. We're taking one day and still trying to move forward. But it is surprising when I read through some magazines or stuff like that and look at what, you know, has been accomplished. It's like, wow, sometimes we're in such a hurry we don't even remember that, you know.
Visiting with trainer Larry Jones on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So what would you consider to be your first really big break?
Well, you know, winning the first stake took pressure off of me. I proved that, okay, that maybe I can win a restricted stakes at Ellis Park, you know. But it wasn't until, you know, as we decided we had moved into our millennium, after 2000, all the 1980s and the 1990s, they were all struggling pretty good. And we had run across a few horses that could run. We was already having, you know, other stake winners. But we felt like we really had our first big break. And in 2002, I did run across a horse in 2000 that ended her career undefeated. She was the Illinois champion 3-year-old filly. So we Ooh. Thought, oh, boy, we've had our first champion. But in 2002, we made our first trip to the Breeders' Cup with what they said was the cheapest horse at that year to run in the Breeders' Cup, a horse called Ruby's Reception. She had run second in the Alcibiades here at Keeneland, and she was already a multiple stakes winner at that time. And she was an $11,000 purchase. So we was able to spend a little money and now then getting out of that $800 stuff and getting the $2,000.
All right, so you go to the Breeders' Cup and you make that first walk and you see all that purple and that gold. What was that like for you?
Well, it was just amazing to even think we were there. You know, it's just, and we knew we better appreciate it because it's probably the only time we're going to get here. So it was one of the deals. It was at Arlington. And but just getting to be around that many horses of that caliber, and just to think that we had an opportunity to participate with them. No, that was good. We felt like, okay, this is our chance of the lifetime, but, you know, we're going to enjoy it, and it'll never happen again.
Did you feel like you belonged?
No, well, not really, but we knew it was just kind of a gift. And I know it was the first mount for the jockey I took, a guy named Terry Thompson. He rode her for us, and he'd been on her when she broke her maiden at Prairie Meadows. So when you're racing at Prairie Meadows, you really don't feel like, okay, I'm going to go to the Breeders' Cup from here. You know, you're just trying to find spots you can win races, and that's what we were doing. But you know, we were just blessed with it, and so it all was good.
You've been responsible for, I don't want to call it making the careers of several jockeys, but putting them into a national spotlight. You mentioned Terry Thompson, Gabe Saez comes to mind, and most recently Kerwin Clark. These are names that people didn't know. They weren't Mike Smith. They weren't Robbie Alvarado. They weren't big names that we see in the sport every day. But somehow, when you've been associated with them, they tend to flourish.
Well, we've just been very lucky that we have owners that will go to the big dance with the, as I say, the girl that brings you there.
Yeah.
You know, you dance with who brought you to the dance. And we've been very blessed and not having to make, you know, last second changes. You know, Mario Pino rode Hard Spun for us. Now, Mario was a guy that won 5,000 races, but had never been in the Kentucky Derby or in Preakness and stuff like this. So it was fun to get to go. And you know, you got a guy that can handle the job, but to get him on the thing, and that's the way we are now with Kerwin. Kerwin has more than paid his dues and he's more than accomplished, but you can't ride any faster than the horses that you ride. And it's been fun there. And like I said, Gabriel, he did us a good job. Gabriel was very young. And with the incident that we went through on our second Kentucky Derby, it really was hard on Gabriel. He was so young. And it affected his career for a while. But anyway, it's we've been very blessed. And thank goodness, like I said, the owners. And I'll tell a funny story on Gabriel because he hadn't been here from Panama long when he was riding a filly called Proud Spell. And she was undefeated, and I told him before we won the race in New York with her, the matron, I said, Gabriel, you know, if we go, I think we're going to get to run this filly in the Breeders' Cup. And I've already asked the owner, and he says he's okay if you ride her in the Breeders' Cup. And he didn't know a lot of English at that time, and he said, okay, you know, give the thumbs up, so we're good. And we did win, and we go to the Breeders' Cup. Gabriel is on, and I keep asking him, are you excited about riding the Breeders' Cup? And it's like, Yeah, you know, it's a horse race. So when he came out, I'll be honest with you, Gabriel was so cool, calm, and collected. There wasn't a jockey on the backside as composed as what he was. And I know Angel Cordero is a very good friend of Gabriel's and mine now because of Gabriel. And he asked him when he come out in the paddock, because he was there with us, and he said, do you have butterflies in your stomach? Gabriel looked at him and said, I don't eat that. He didn't have a clue what we're talking about. So he shook the hands with the governor, you know, and here we go. We get up on the horse. But I'll never forget, I'm walking around the walking ring, and there's people everywhere at Monmouth Park. And he looked at me. He said, what are all these people doing here? And I thought, he ain't got a clue. And that's good. That's yeah. a good thing. He wasn't nervous, and he rode his race and rode an outstanding race. We run second to Indian Blessing, which was the champion two-year-old filly. But the pressure never got to him. But, yeah, so that was fun. Sometimes bringing someone in inexperienced can also be a blessing to you and be ahead. And, of course, he did win the Oaks the following year on Proud Spell. And so, no, it was all good.
It's been an amazing run for trainer Larry Jones and for those associated with him. We're going to continue this visit right after this short commercial break. We're going to talk about Heartspun and Proud Spell and a little filly you might have heard of by the name of Harve de Grace. It's coming up next here. Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton.
The Fasig Tipton Yearling Sales, your roadmap to success. In 2014, the Fasig Tipton Saratoga sale, July sale, and New York bread sale were ranked the top three sales in North America by rate of return. And the July sale was once again a top-ranked sale by percentage of graded stakes winning graduates, with an average of more than $94,000, including undefeated leading Kentucky Derby contender, Dortmund.
Dortmund is all heart. He shifted his ground a little, but he's clear. And Dortmund, another stylish performance. Dortmund wins.
The Fasig Tipton Saratoga sale is annually the number one ranked North American yearling sale by percentage of grade one winners. In 2014, the Saratoga sale boasted a $291,000 average and a median of more than $237,000, with past graduates including grade one Don Handicap winner Constitution and the brilliant juvenile champion American Pharoah.
American Pharoah will romp home in the Rebel.
It's never too late to nominate, so make plans now to sell your yearlings at the leading sales in North America. Visit FasigTipton.com to nominate today.
The New York Thoroughbred Breeding and Development Fund means business for New York. Together with all equine pursuits in the Empire State, we pay more than $187 million in taxes and provide 33,000 jobs. We provide scholarships for young people who want to join the New York horse industry, and we encourage everyone to support all thoroughbreds all their lives. Visit nybreds.com to learn more about why the fund means business.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
Thursday evenings, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern, is the Briznet.com call-in show. It's your chance to call in and let the Horse Racing Radio Nation know what's on your mind. Call us at 888-966-HRRN and discuss the topics you choose in the world of thoroughbred racing. The Briznet.com call-in show, every Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern, on Sirius 220 and XM 206, or streaming live online at horseracingradio.net.
If you missed the Equine Forum, you missed a lot.
Jockey Chuck Lopez, he's with me now on the Equine Forum. El Kabir can give CC that elusive grade one in today's Wood Memorial. right, we're going to make sure Javier Castellano isn't listening to this so that he doesn't get any tips on your strategy today, Chuck.
It won't matter because when they say go, you can plan all you want. You can read the form all you want. And you can take all the instructions and throw them out the window. I prefer to ride by the seat of my pants. I mean, I do look at the form and I kind of can figure out where everybody should be. But when they open the gates, you have no idea what's going to happen.
The Equine Forum, giving you the inside track on thoroughbred racing. Saturday mornings, 8 to 10 a.m. on Sirius XM Channel 92 and always streaming live at horseracingradio.net.
Hi, this is Chris McCarron, and you're listening to the best horse racing show on the radio on Horse Racing Radio Network.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And the field turns for home. It is still Roll holding on. Have the Grace is full out. And those two in a battle as they enter the final furlong now. In behind them, flat out is third. And the filly is in front. It is Have the Grace. Flat out with the final try coming down to the finish. And it will be Have the Grace. In the spirit of Rachel Alexandra, winning the Woodward here by a length over Flat Out, Roll the Pacemaker was third. The final time was 1 minute 49 seconds flat. The filly did it.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna continuing our visit with trainer Larry Jones here this evening. And boy, what a career it has been. And you just heard that race clip of Harve de Grace winning the Woodward Stakes back in 2011. And Larry, I know we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves. We haven't even talked about Hard Spun and Proud Spell and those types of horses that were earlier in your career. But you look at 2011, and here comes eventual Horse of the Year, Harve de Grace. Here comes Believe You Can. Here comes Joyful Victory. Just absolutely incredible.
Well, we were once again very blessed. You know, I announced that I was going to quit training in 2000 and at the end of 2009. And my wife took the stable over for 2010 because I was having some health issues I didn't realize I was having. But I did get some time then to start taking care of Larry for the first time. And then once I got my problems kind of straightened out and going, then I came back. And what a blessing it was. Rick wanted us to take those horses. And it was so good. Have it a grace. I've told everyone that, you know, I feel like that was the nearest thing to a perfect horse that I'll ever get to touch, you know, because all horses have some kind of a little hole card. But she had nothing. It didn't matter what kind of pace was in the race. It didn't matter what post position she drew. Didn't matter where the race was at. She would ship and go for it. What a phenomenal filly she was.
Yeah, she was unbelievable. And, of course, going on, as I mentioned, to be voted Horse of the Year in that particular season in 2011. You mentioned Rick Porter. Talk about that relationship. He's been with you for a very long time.
We started in 2006. That was the year that I moved the string to Delaware Park out of Kentucky. The tornado hit Ellis Park in 2005. So we had to try to find another place we could call home for a while. And thanks to John Service, which was his trainer at that time, was going to take a little bit of time off for some family issues. He recommended me to get a few of the horses, and so we did. And Heartspun was one of the gifts that we got. And I can remember when I went out to the barn to look at him, you know, we had this Danzig horse. Well, he didn't look like a Danzig. I mean, he was tall and lanky, and what I knew about Danzigs, he didn't fit the mold. But boy, what a good way to break the mold. He was such a good horse. And yeah, that's kind of how we got started.
And he took you down to your first Kentucky Derby.
He did. And so once again, it was just things that you always felt like you dreamed of, but it wasn't going to happen. I mean, believe me, I was at Ellis Park running $2,500 horses. And like I said, we had a few stake winners. And actually, I'd already run second in a Kentucky Oaks at that time. And that is how I met John Service, because that was the year he had that horse called Smarty Jones.
Yeah.
And I had Island Sand, and then we went and won the Acorn with Island Sand in 2004. So that gave Rick a little bit of confidence to send some horses to us, and it's just been a blessing. Rick is a great guy, has become a wonderful friend. Not only is he, as I say, he's my boss, he has really got to be a great friend of ours, and what a wonderful man he is.
Hard spun. People may forget this. He turned for home in the Derby in front by three. What's that moment like?
I was looking at the people around me, and I thought, we're going to win the Derby. We're going to win. And this poor dang horse called Street Sense, I'm watching, and there's no way. When I'm starting to realize I've got a real shot in this Derby, we're not just a pace factor. We're going to get there. How can he get to me from where he is, you know, on that rail? And at that time, everybody starts moving out, trying to make sure they get a racing position. And here come Calvin. And so it was good. You know, run second in the Derby the first year. Oh, we were just tickled to death. So it was good. I still can't watch the replay of how Street Sense got that trip. But I do like Carl Nafker, maybe not as much as I did before the race, but I still like him.
And, did you say anything to him afterwards?
Oh, we've talked about it a lot, yes. And I did get the ability or the opportunity to run against Street Sense four times with Hardspun. We won two and he won two. So at least we just quit while we was even, and that was good. And I say we won two. I beat him twice. He beat me twice. We didn't win the races all the time, but at least I beat him.
That was also the year 2007 when Proud Spell was starting to kind of come into her own as a two-year-old. She, of course, would win the Kentucky Oaks. Yeah. The following year, that relationship you have with former Kentucky Governor Brereton Jones is another very special relationship.
Well, it really is. I guess the first time maybe he had heard of me, I claimed a horse off of him at Ellis Park for $5,000, and we wound up doing very well with the horse. I mean, it turned out to be a really nice horse. So at least then he knew who I was, and we had already were doing a lot of breeding at his farm with our mares from Hopkinsville. We bred a lot of his stallions, and they were super nice people to work with, but I'll never forget. And we had bought a few horses from him at the sale, so we're becoming at least acquaintances. So he had told me in 2006, he said he had some RNAs in there, and he told me, he said, Larry, go through there, pick you out an RNA, and I'm going to send that horse to you next year. I want you to train one for me. And at that time, we didn't even know we were going to Delaware, you know. It was good. So I go down, and he was showing a horse in the ring. I'll never forget about it. And I told him, whatever stall number it was, 26, whatever it was. I told him, I said, Governor, if you'll send me the horse in 26. I checked him. That's the one I want. It's a good one. And he was showing another horse to someone up there. So he said, okay, he's yours. So I go up to the sales ring. And I'll never forget, he come up to me about 30 minutes later, and he said, you're going to think I'm a politician and that I'm a liar, but I'm not going to send you that horse you picked out. So I just laughed. I mean, I've been spun before. And I told him, I said, well, that's okay. Not a problem. He said, no, you don't understand. The guy I was showing the horse to heard what you said. He went down and looked at him, and he bought him.
Wow.
And I told him, I said, well, Governor, I said, 30 minutes, I'll go down, we'll do this again. He said, no, I'm not trying to do that. And I told him, I said, just send me something. Just send me something. So the next spring, he called me and said, I've got two horses I'm going to send you. One is a Yankee gentleman, one's a proud citizen. So anyway, I said, okay, fine. So when they come off the load, it winds up, I don't even have the Yankee gentleman. I've got two proud citizens. And it was the first crop of proud citizens. And I thought, boy, this guy changes his mind a lot. But when they got ready to load the trailer, the Yankee gentleman was sick and you know, spiked a little fever. They didn't want to ship him, so they just sent me another horse that they liked. And as it turned out, the other proud citizen was Proud Spell.
Wow.
And so I told him after, I said, you just pick them from now. I'm not even going to try to. When you send me Eclipse Award winners, you just pick them any way you want to.
That's a great story. You know, and you think about where you were at that point in your career, and then going into 2008, all the momentum from 07 carries over. Proud Spell jumps up, runs huge. She wins the Kentucky Oaks. We know the Eight Bells story. She runs her eyeballs out in the Kentucky Derby. We know what happened there. How difficult was that time period after Eight Bells for you personally?
Well, without a doubt, that was probably the most strenuous thing I've ever gone through in horse racing. You know, actually both of those horses had been entered in the Oaks, and Eight Bells had won, get through the 14 hole. But we had actually sent Eight Bells to Oaklawn just to get her away from Proud Spell, because Proud Spell at that time was our marquee horse, you know. So we moved Eight Bells up, knew she was an up-and-coming horse. But so we went for the what we felt like, just get away from this one and we'll be okay, kind of the way Lovely Maria and Chatterbox are having to do this year.
Yeah.
Just put them at another track. So anyway, we did, and then Eight Bells just blossomed. And so needless to say, she wound up running in the Derby, and both horses that ran their eyeballs out, Proud Spell did win the Oaks. And that's what Rick Porter had told me. He said, Larry, he said, I really would like to have mine in the Derby. He said, but we can run in the Oaks. He said, but I'm going to be honest, I think you're going to win the Oaks with or without Eight Bells. And so he said, I'll run mine in the Derby where we're not running against each other. So we did. And and both horses just ran incredible. And so after that, I hate to say, you know, we'd run second with Hardspun the year before and was so happy. And this time we run second, and it's like the first impulse was, dang, second again. You know, and because I never even thought I'd run in a Derby.
Yeah.
And then after we ran in the first one, I told Rick, I said, you know, now then I don't want to run in the Derby. I want to win a Derby. And so the next year we you know, think we got our shot. And now then our attitude was changed. I had actually had the favorite in 2009, and he only beat one horse, and we were grateful. He just come back to the barn sound. It was like, okay, you know, winning isn't everything in this. We're just glad we still got our horse.
I can remember after the Eight Bells incident, all of a sudden people were accusing Larry Jones of drugging the horse and running a horse that wasn't sound just to get her in the Kentucky Derby, and all these false accusations that came out, Larry. And then you were even receiving hate mail, I remember, right?
Yeah.
I can't even imagine what that's like for a human being.
Sure.
Forget about a horse trainer. A human being to have to go through something like that.
Yeah, it was definitely tough, and as I said, it really, and Gabriel was the you know, he was taking the blunt of it too, and I'm glad that I was older and my skin was a little thicker, because it was even hard on me at that. A lot of people thought that was why I had retired, but like I said, my own health was the reason that I was having to kind of back out of it at that time. Didn't know what was going on with me. And but anyway, it's we have all kind of overcome. She'll always have it that spot in her heart. And that's why I had them test her for everything in the world, and you know, including the steroids, which she had none, and she passed every test in flying colors, what they did. And so, but it's I found out that in the world there's a lot of haters, and it don't matter who they hate, they just want to hate somebody.
Yeah.
And we was getting to hear, I think, from each, and I hope it was each and every one. I would hate to think there's a lot more out there that I didn't hear from. But we also had our good people too. We had the good letters that were far exceeded the bad ones, but those bad ones would stick with you.
How has that experience changed you?
Well, I don't think I take anything for granted. And like I said, we're just always grateful. As I said, with Frisian Fire, when he ran bad, it wasn't like, oh man, we ran bad. It's like, okay, big boy, you live and fight another day. And you don't take everything as serious. It's not all about just, okay, if we don't win this, it's over. You know, just go out and do your best. And you know, you take all these blessings and just try to acknowledge them.
Well, they say what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
It, but I hope I never have to test it that hard again to see if I'm stronger or not.
Visiting with trainer Larry Jones here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So the next year you do step away from the game for a year. Tough decision to make.
It really was, and because we were trying to actually find somebody that we felt comfortable with taking over the stable, because we didn't want to leave these owners hanging, and that's why I give them a year to notice that I'm going to quit. This is just, it's more than I can't want to deal with. And when things just, we wasn't finding, we felt like the right people to take it over, and that's when Cindy said, well, you know, we'd already cut the barn down a lot. And she said, well, I'll just train them for a while. We'll just see what happens. And all of those owners were agreeable to let her be the trainer. And I told them, I said, I'd be there. All I want to do is be a gallop boy. I can still gallop, and I'll do that. But I'm going to put in my 4 hours a day, and I'm going home. And because I was having a lot of trouble, I couldn't remember things, and the pressure was getting to me. And it wound up, as we found out, I had extremely high levels of aluminum in my body. And the number one side effect of that is dementia, and I knew I was losing my mind. But once we got the aluminum then taken care of, but you always put that kind of stuff off. Well, I don't have time today. We've got to be in Monmouth. We got to be somewhere else. I'll go to the doctor later. But at least that time, it gave me enough time to, okay, I got to see what I've got. And didn't know if I was going to have Alzheimer's, what it was, but when it was something just as simple as too much aluminum, and we started trying to get that flushed out of the body, and then everything started getting back normal. So it was all good.
I can remember you referring to that year as kind of similar to turning a horse out and giving them a freshening.
Yes.
And then you come back and it's a whole other game. You're back to where you were. Is that the way you viewed that?
It really was. And by the end, when Cindy had quit, about the end of her training time, I was starting to get the itch, not thinking it's got to all be in my name. I was fine, but I was doing more around the barn all the time. It wasn't the 4 hours going in and galloping and going home. It was I was sticking around to do a lot of the other stuff, so it was all good. But like I said, and it's been good since we've started back.
What did you miss most?
Well, really nothing, because the whole operation didn't change. It wasn't a lot of difference with her doing it than me, other than, she was telling me which horses I was going to gallop, which ones I wanted to gallop was different. she pretty well let me still do that part. But it was, thank goodness, with her taking over, things didn't change a lot. And that is why I was able to step back in the very next year and go to the very highest level, is because we didn't have to start from scratch. It was all still right there. I mean, Cindy had a grade one winner for the governor that year, and no such word. And that was her last race as a trainer. I can remember after the race, she said, "Now look, winning these grade ones, that ain't all that hard. I don't want to hear it anymore. You take over and you do it. I don't want to be a grade one too." So, that was her last race as a trainer, was winning the grade one Gazelle in New York. And I told her, I said, it might be the best horse race that we ever won, because that was in November, and we'd moved the string to Oaklawn, and we never even made another start until the middle of January. So we got 6 weeks to enjoy that last race.
Wow.
And it wasn't a defeat, so it was good.
Tell me about some of the other horses that you've had the chance to be around, other than the big names that we've already talked about, that you're never going to forget. They're always going to stick out to you.
Well, I need to say the very first, the stake winner was a horse called Captain Bold, to go into the Fazzik Tipton sale and pick up this $800 horse. It lets you know everybody's got a shot in this game. And for him to be our first stake winner, he's always good. I had a horse named, probably one of my favorite thoroughbreds, was a horse named Casa Con Carlos, because he really liked me. And he made a nice little allowance horse. But they would train him, and he had some issues. I mean, and when I was gone, he didn't want to train. They couldn't catch him in the field a lot of time. But I'd walk out there, and he'd come running. This is one of the few horses that I can say he really liked me. So he was special to you. But we've had a lot, and we've just been blessed with so many good horses. But a lot of the horses, although they're not the stable names, they get dear to you too.
And horses, you said that horse really, really liked you.
Yeah.
You can develop that type of relationship with a horse?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. But you could tell, and it wasn't something I worked at on him. I know when I saw him at the sale, and it was another Fazzik Tipton sale, the guy that had him, this horse came out and was just sky leaping and jumping and carrying on, looked like he never had a halter on. And the guy was a friend of mine that had him. And he said, "I don't know what's in him. He's never acted like this." I said, "Well, he looks pretty athletic." And my trailer was full. I'd already bought a trailer load. I told him, I said, "Look, if you don't get your RNA on him, take his horse home, and I'll pick him up when I come by the farm." So he called me later that day. He said, "Well, you've got the horse." And it's just like it was meant to be. And what a neat horse he was. Like I said, and he was our version of Silky Sullivan. I remember the first allowance race he won. I told the owners, I said, because they like to gamble a little bit. I said, "Well, you can put a little money on this horse. He's okay." I think he was like 23-1. And I said, "Wow. I like him." And when he come out of the gates, is his first time to run long, they called him in front. He took the break really well. But the very next call, he's dead last by several. And when they start down the backside at Ellis Park, he's 12 lengths behind any horse. And it's like, oh, wow. And the owners are looking at me, and it's like, oh, no. So I told Cindy, I said, "I'm going to the paddock. I don't know what's happening. I'm going to go get this horse." And so as we're going down the steps at Ellis Park, I see when they get to the turn, he had gotten up to about 3 lengths of the last horse. He had done made up about 9 lengths. And then I looked. First time I'd even looked at the field, it wasn't 3 lengths between first and next to last. I told her, I said, "Well, he's not going to run last." And I said, "And one thing about it, when he gets by one, he's going to go by them all." We had daylight on the field at the eighth pole. This horse could make such a big move. It was unreal. And it's just like it would just drop your jaw. But he had touted me all week long. It's just like, "I'm fixing to run big," and he did.
Earlier you told me that you can't go back and watch the replay of the Kentucky Derby with Heartspun when you were second behind Street Sense that year. How often will you go back and watch replays of some of those big races and big-name horses like, say, Harve de Grace?
Well, we'll watch them like now that it's, 4 or 5 years later, and it's always good to watch them and to go immediately after the race. I usually don't watch them a lot unless I feel like there's something that we got to figure out. You know, if we felt like we had a good run, I don't pay a lot of attention to them now because we have so many horses going. But it's fun just every now and then to go back and recap, especially Proud Spell, the first time she beat Indian Blessing. Indian Blessing had never been beat. And the ride that Gabriel put on her in order to win, it's just like, wow, that was really good. It was a very smart ride. And so those kind of things, they're always fun. And I have one, and it was the very horse that I run. Rick Mocklin was the announcer at Ellis Park. And I had a horse named Poverty Slew. It was the first $100,000 race that I run.
Okay.
And as they turned for home, all of a sudden my horse just breaks free. And I'll never forget, he said, you know, and Poverty Slew is fleeing the scene. And it still makes the hair raise up on the back of my neck today when I look at that, the same spot every time, the hair will just raise up on my neck. It's
wow.
Unbelievable. So, yeah, a lot of them get to you.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. And they really do become like members of your family. Take me inside Larry Jones' house and your memorabilia that you have around the house. So what's your favorite piece of memorabilia?
Well, you know, we're fortunate. Yeah, I get a house that when we're in Delaware, we get to live at, and then of course got our log cabin here in Kentucky, and that's the one where we have most of the memorabilia. But we have a huge picture of Abbott of Grace, you know, that is wall size.
Wow.
that we have up. And it's what they had used whenever they ran her through the sale at Fazzik Tipton. And so they got me a copy of it. But we have, you know, we have different walls for different horses. And the only thing in there that's not horse racing stuff is we do have a football jersey for Peyton Manning on the wall.
No kidding.
Other than
Where did that come
it's all,
from?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe he hot walked for us sometime. I don't know. But, yeah, it was the football jersey when he won the little Super Bowl thing. So, yeah.
Have you ever had a chance to meet him?
I have not. No. But of course, we do New Orleans. It feels like we're supposed to because he grew up there.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have so much stuff on them there. But no, never have got to meet him.
How about some of the famous celebrities or famous athletes that you had the chance to meet? Who are a couple of them?
Well, you know, I'd done a horse racing interview, and they'd asked me that. Who is your favorite athlete? And of course, I'm an old guy. And I told them, I said, well, it's Dan Issel. You know, no
yeah.
doubt. He was the man at UK, and he makes the NBA, and, you know, and all this. And I think at that time, the fourth leading scorer of all time. I told him, I said, I guess he's my favorite. And that was the year we was in New Orleans, and they had the NCAA tournaments there. So I'm out there, and Governor Jones is there, and he hollers out the door. He said, Larry, there's a man out here who wants to meet you. And I said, well, I'll be right there, you know. And I said, who is it? Do you know? He said, well, as tall as he is, it looks like Dan Issel. Well, needless to say, I dropped what I had in my hands, and I go out. I thought he was joking with me. And there's Dan Issel standing there, and we have got to be good acquaintances over that. His grandson was there. I tacked the pony up. His grandson was riding the pony around. What a great guy. And he had heard that because he's a horse racing fan, too.
Yeah.
And plus, he was in New Orleans. So it was really, really good.
I've often found that when I meet people like that, all I want to ask them about is what they do, and they
yeah.
want to ask me about horse racing.
Sure.
I don't want to talk about horse racing.
Yeah.
I want to talk about basketball.
That's
with
it.
Somebody like Dan Issel.
Yeah.
Were you the same way?
Well, actually, it was just I was still in awe. And then I had another guy. I was at Churchill, and it's a kind of a funny story. I was so hot, and it's a year believe you can, and Mark Valesky was going to the Derby and the Oaks there.
Yeah.
And Todd Boston, which was shoeing a horse out there for me, he said, Larry, there's a guy here who wants to meet you. And, of course, at Derby week, you have all of that, you know. I told him, I said, look, I am so hot. Let me get out of these clothes. I'll be right out. And I wasn't in a huge hurry. I wasn't just dragging my feet, but I did go out. And of course, the guy's in sunglasses and a ball cap and all like that. And I said, who, Todd? He said, this guy right here. And I shook out my hand and said, well, I'm Larry Jones. He said, well, I'm Terry Bradshaw. And then he took his – I said, oh, my gosh, y'all could have told me. And then Terry beat me the very next race we was in at New Orleans. His horse ran one, and we were second.
He had a nice horse, yeah.
He did. But it's not like, oh, Larry's my friend. I'm going to cut him some slack. No. It's like, okay, take this, boy. But, no, it was really neat. And Terry hung around the barn, you know, good 15, 20 minutes. And we talked quarter horses. We talked because he's in all of it, too. And what a great guy he was to talk to.
You know, we started this conversation, by the way, visiting with Larry Jones here on Trainer Talk presented by Fazzik Tipton. We started the conversation earlier by me mentioning that you are probably one of the more accommodating trainers when it comes to working with the media, and several trainers will make themselves available. But a few years back, you were honored with the Big Sport of Turfdom Award, which is given out by the media. That had to be a huge thrill for you, too. How much does that mean to you?
Yeah, believe me, to me, when I see the people, John Forsyth and of course, John Sheriffs and all of one, but when you see the people, Jack Klugman, I mean, people you know are famous, and you receive the same award they do. And it was real funny. And I'd been on the phone all time, and that's when the cell phones, was really getting into my life. It had been in other people's lives for a long time. But I didn't answer my phone one call. And Cindy said, well, you got a phone call coming in. I said, look, you answer. I'm not answering. I've talked all I can talk. And it happened to be Eric Wing, and that's what it was. And she said, the Big Sport of Turfdom Award. I said, give me that phone. And so that's when Eric called me. I said, the first phone call I turned down, and it was from him on that award. But, yes, it was so great and so honored. And believe me, it's wonderful.
If you could go back to the beginning in 1982 and knowing what you know now and everything you've been through, the highs, the lows, is there anything that you would do differently?
I wouldn't have started with $155. I made sure I had $200 because there were times I couldn't eat too much. I don't think if I did it any different, it would turn out the same. So, no. Now, a young person coming up doing it, can I give him some advice to avoid some of the stuff I did? Yeah, I could. But like I said, that was the only way I had in, because I come from non-horse racing area, and I had no connections to get in with anybody. So it was one of these deals. I was an owner first. Then I went to the trainer because my trainer told me when I made a suggestion or two, like I found out owners will sometimes do. I wasn't out of line. I was just telling him. And his attitude was, well, if you can do it better, you need to do it yourself. And I thought, well, maybe I should. Farming's not good. Maybe I'll give this a try. And so I took his advice, and it's gone from there. So now it's all been good.
So what advice would you give to a new trainer coming into the game today?
Well, not to be in too big of a hurry about trying to just get out on your own. Get under somebody to study, because I had no mentors. I mean, other than the fact I just kind of knew horses from growing up and knew a whole lot about other livestock as well that I could apply over into the horses, just hopefully being animal smart, covered me on a whole lot of the other smart I didn't have. But yes, just try to have some connections, and work for reputable people that really know the game and just not get in a big hurry, that your time will come.
I've asked a lot of trainers this question, Larry, and the answers are always so diverse. So I'm going to ask you, when you look back on your career, what are you most proud of?
Oh, geez. I guess that I've lived this long and not gotten killed by some of these horses I've been on. Now, hopefully, my ambition when I started wasn't to try to break any kind of training records. It wasn't trying to get rich. I wanted people to think that there's a good horseman. He's good with horses, and that's all I was shooting for. Ellis Park. I just wanted to be known as a good horseman at Ellis Park. And we try to do right by the horses. We try to do the right things. I know all of my owners tell me I have the lowest vet bills of anybody that trains for them. So we still do things a lot of the old school way. We spend a lot of time under the horses instead of just, have the veterinarians do everything for us. So I'm kind of proud of that. And it's just the people that I've got to meet. We have met some of the greatest people in this game that you could ever hope to imagine to meet. And I get to train for a lot of them. That's even better. It's been a good life. It's a lot of early mornings and a lot of late nights and a lot of white lines driving under that truck. But it's all good.
Just a minute and a half or so left before we do have to wrap up this trainer talk visit, and it's been very enjoyable, Larry. I can't thank you enough for taking the time, but what does the future hold? What else would you like to accomplish that you haven't quite done yet?
If it was all to end tomorrow, I would just have to smile and say it was better than I ever dreamed it would be. We have, when I look at some of the accomplishments we've done, it's like, wow. I mean, some of them went by so fast we wasn't even realizing it was happening. I think everybody, like to win me a Derby someday and all like that and win the Breeders' Cup. But I don't have any race set out to win that we haven't won. I mean, this year it'd be nice to win the Kentucky Oaks again. But it's that next race you're in. You want to win that next one. I mean, I'm in a $50,000 claimer here Wednesday with a horse I own. I really want to win that one. But it's been good. And like I said, if it was all over tomorrow, there would be no regrets on me.
It's been an amazing ride. All the best to your wife, Cindy, as well, and all the best moving forward here. And again, can't thank you enough for spending a little time. Like all of our guests, you're going to receive a gift from one of our sponsors. That's Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We'll get those out to you. And again, really appreciate it, Larry. All the best.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Larry Jones here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. What a visit. What a career. And it's still going and going strong. Don't forget, if you missed any portion of the show, go to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast. You can also check it out, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. And we're back with you every single Wednesday night right here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. For my producer, Lee Delapina, and for Larry Jones, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time here on Trainer Talk.